we spend a tremendous amount of our time, especially in the digital world, doing the black hat stuff, right? And we don't get to the white hat things, the, you know, doing things that are actually impactful and meaningful and pursuing your hobby and relationships. But we're just not happy, right? So to combat that, there's two ways to do it. It's all systematic based on the framework. Number one is, as BJ Fogg, this is a Stanford professor of behavior, he says, you need to change your environment, right? And so, which means you literally need to remove the black hat from your life. That's why some people go to a retreat, they go in the mountains, they go to a dojo. And once all these black hat triggers are gone, no more deadlines, emails shooting at you, you know, exclusive offers, then you're like, all right, what do I actually want to do? I want to focus on things I care about, right?
So that was our guest, Yukai Chow. He's an author and international keynote speaker on gamification and behavioral design. He's also the author of the book Actionable Gamification, Beyond Points, Badges, and Leaderboards. In this episode, Yukai's going to talk to us about what his Octalysis framework actually is, what black hat and white hat strategies are, and also how you can integrate these into your daily lives to help you reach more of your goals that you set for yourself. But before we start, I want to welcome you to the Digital Mindfulness Show. Here, we bring together the best experts from around the world who focus on discovering and creating time-well-spent digital experiences. Over the past 4 years, we've brought together global thought leaders to discuss the latest thinking on topics such as digital wellness, ethical computing, digital detoxing, mindful technology, information overload, children and technology, and much, much more. To find out more about us and to join our growing international community, go to digitalmindfulness.net, where you'll find some required listening podcasts and also links to our upcoming international events. Okay, let's get on with the show. I hope you enjoy listening to Yukai Chow. Yukai, welcome to Digital Mindfulness. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Yukai, why don't you start by telling the audience a little bit about yourself, your work, and in particular, how you came to focus on it?
Okay. So, before 2003, like many people of my generation, I was a very heavy gamer. At the time, I quit a game called Diablo 2, and I realized I invested thousands of hours into growing the character inside of a game, getting gear, leveling up, learning the right skills, having alliances. But once I quit the game, I really had nothing in the real world. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I spent those thousands of hours learning a new language or playing the violin? I would actually be high level in real life, not just in the game. And so that started me off in a journey of being obsessed about two things. One is how to create games where the more hours you spend on it, the better real life is. And the second is how to make life itself just more fun and interesting. So at the beginning, it's just a passion that I had. It was a really interesting topic. And there wasn't really an industry around it, but I was very lucky and blessed where after maybe 8 years, this field called gamification suddenly became something that companies, organizations, governments, and of course, individuals who just want to better themselves got very interested in. And they looked around. I was the only person who's been doing it for, one of the only people, I guess, who have been doing it for so long. So I published a book. I have a blog, yukaichow.com. That's relatively popular. And nowadays I spend most of the time either coaching people, coaching companies about a framework I created called the Octalysis Framework to drive more motivation, either for their employees or customers or themselves. And I have an education platform called Octalysis Prime. So entrepreneur, speaker, writer, designer is what I'm doing these days.
It's interesting to me that you identify yourself as a gamer so early on in your life. And it would have been about that time when games perhaps weren't taken so seriously right at the beginning when they began to proliferate amongst young people. And I'm wondering, did you find any resistance or any challenges to be taken seriously amongst companies that you initially approached to work with?
Oh, completely. And at the beginning, I didn't even think it was a sellable skill. Most people didn't understand it. They didn't believe in it. They actually thought I was creating excuses to play more games. Like you mentioned, I was a boy, right? I wasn't trying to sell the service. I was just excited about it. Now, my first year in college, I did start a company, a tech startup called FD Career, and was about gamifying your profession. So it's targeting college students and young professionals and turning their career development into an RPG game, role-playing game. And that one was actually rated a top 10 social network for Gen Ys by Mashable. And we had some partners with Disney and whatnot. So it did pretty well. So it wasn't more about, oh, I wanted people to take the concept of gamification more seriously. To the younger generation, they thought, okay, career made fun is a great idea. And to the companies, I tell them, hey, look, you can recruit better talents through giving quests. And like, for instance, when people resolve the Disney quest, they automatically get a first round interview. So that was growing its wings. But then the 2007-2008 financial crisis hit, and all the companies we were, because our business model was to help companies recruit talent better through it, but all the companies were looking to lay off everyone they could. So our platform that helps them hire more people wasn't very useful. So we then pivoted to social media ranking. So having, and this is the early days of social media too, so having bloggers and people on Twitter compete about who is more influential on a leaderboard, etc. So so we moved around into different startups. They're all, again, it wasn't a clear idea of this is called gamification, but it was all about my passion of making important things fun. It was more about 2010, 2012, where there's an actual industry, and I stepped down as a CEO of my previous startup. And I said, hey, I'm just going to write about what I learned, you know, and what I know. And that's when it really blew up. And that's where I get invited to speak at places like Stanford University and Google and Lego, and help companies like Volkswagen and et cetera.
That's great. Thanks for that. So I'm wondering now for the audience, because I really want to shift the discussion now to talking about the Optelesis framework and again, how you came about that. But just tell us exactly what that is and why it's so important.
Okay, in a nutshell, so the Octalysis framework, first of all, it's called the Octalysis because it's a combination of the word octagon and analysis. So it's a framework that understands human motivation and engagement, and it's seen in an octagon. So basically, it was developed through years of research of exactly what makes a game fun. Gamification these days sometimes have a bad rep because people just stick with what we call the PBLs, points, badges, or leaderboards. They just think, oh, if we stick points and badges on something, suddenly it's super fun, or to a great extent, if we add quests or leveling up or whatnot. And my observation is that these game techniques, these game design elements don't make a game fun, because if you look in the market, every single game has game elements in them, but most games are still failures, right? So just because you put in some game design element that are even found in boring, failing games into your product, into your lifestyle, doesn't mean it's suddenly exciting. So I did a lot of research to understand what exactly makes a game fun. And so the result of it is the Octalysis framework I published on my blog, and it was translated, I think, into over 16 different languages organically in a year. And so what it is, it breaks down all human motivation into 8 core drives. So every single thing we do inside or outside of a game is based in one or more of these 8 core drives, which means that if there's none of these 8 core drives there's zero motivation, no behavior happens. And out of these 8 core drives, there's different natures of those core drives. There's what we call white hat versus black hat. So motivation, so white hat core drives make people feel powerful, in control, they feel good, but there's no sense of urgency, so people procrastinate. And then the black hat core drives make people feel urgent, obsessed, even addicted, but in the long run leaves a bad taste in their mouths because, you know, we feel like we're not in control of their own behavior. So, you know, we talk about digital mindfulness, right? A lot of times in our lives, most things are black hat, the triggers, the loss and avoidance, things that keep sucking us in. And black hat is really good at driving obsessive behavior, but we're not happy. White hat are the things that there's no urgency to it, but if we spend time doing those things, it makes us happier. So things like epic meaning and calling, doing things that are impactful, changing the world, or getting close to our faiths, whatnot. Development accomplishment, that's core drive 2. So learning a new skill, advancing yourself, achieving mastery. And then core drive 3 is empowerment of creative feedback, which is using your creativity, having a lot of autonomy, meaningful choices, etc. And then there's also the left versus right side of octagon. So white and black is top and bottom. There's left versus right. I call them left brain versus right brain core drives. Doesn't necessarily mean that they are geographically on the left versus right, but the left brain core drives deal with the logical brain in a representative way. The right brain core drive is symbolically representing the emotional brain. And the left brain core drives deal with extrinsic motivation, things you do for a reward, a purpose, or a goal. But we don't necessarily enjoy the activity itself. So once we obtain the reward, we hit our goals, or we get used to the reward, we stop doing the activity. And then the right brain core drives deal with intrinsic motivation, things that we just enjoy doing to the point that we would even pay money just to experience. So again, that's a big nutshell. So basically, our work is really just about understanding motivation, but also understand the nature of it. Is it long term? Is it short term? Does it make people happy or not? Is it obsessive? Is it intrinsic, extrinsic? And that pretty much sums up the Actalysis framework, and until you go deeper into how it all works.
So up until now, you've been talking a lot about white hat and black hat approaches, and how they can be applied, of course, to the Actalysis framework. But I wonder if you can just explain whether these approaches can be used to help people generate more positive behaviors, because you said that these were in general linked to negative behaviors, like tracking those and identifying those.
The white hat and black hat is the nature of the motivation, and then there is the behavior itself. So you can use black hat motivation to get people addicted to eating carrots or exercising more, and that's a result people want. But you can also use white hat to motivate people to doing really bad things. In fact, a lot of the dictators in history, they sometimes use epic meaning and calling to inspire, like, you know, some things like genocide, right? And so there's what you try to motivate people to do that could be good or evil. And then there's the white hat, black hat, which is, well, how do you feel about the motivation? When people do evil things based on epic meaning and calling, they actually think that, oh, I'm making the world better. They feel great about it. But of course, dictators also add black hat in the form of loss and avoidance. If you don't do it, I'm going to kill you, right? And that is also very compelling. People will do these actions because they don't want to get killed, but they don't feel good about that motivation. So there's a clear distinction between good evil and then black hat, white hat.
You started to talk, Yukai, about some examples, particularly those of dictators who would have embodied certain parts of the different examples of Actalysis that you were talking about. And I wonder if you can just give some greater examples of the ways that people would see Actalysis in their daily lives.
When we talk about black hat versus white hat, right? So again, white hat core drives empower, epic meaning and calling, development accomplishment, empowerment of creativity and feedback. So again, those are the things that we intend to do. If we actually do it, it makes us feel very happy, but we never get to it because there's no urgency. Like, we're in full control. Now, the black hat things are the things that we end up doing all day. So the three core drives are loss and avoidance, and scarcity and impatience, unpredictability and curiosity. So I'll go through a few examples about how these black hat core drives actually distract us for the context of this podcast. So loss and avoidance are, you're doing something to avoid a loss. You don't want something bad to happen. And those are like deadlines, right? There's things you want to do, but then there's these deadlines and you just end up doing these things for deadlines all day long. Scarcity are about exclusive promotions, about things that you just can't have. So you're obsessive about. It's staying in line. Like, some people think they're really, really busy. They don't have time for anything. They don't have time to go to the gym, but they can stand in line for 3 hours to get the next iPhone, right? So that scarcity drives behavior too. And then unpredictability and curiosity, which is the gambling core drive. It's on the right bottom of the octagon, so that intrinsic and black hat. So intrinsic as in our brains enjoy it. Unpredictability, like when we are stuck on show like Game of Thrones, right? Our brains enjoy it, but it's black hat. We feel like we're not in control of our own behavior. So we wanted to go to bed at 11 p.m. or 12, but then we end up going to bed at 4 because of that that black hat nature of it. So some people, the scientists show that when you actually pull out your Facebook and you pull down, you refresh your feed to the brain, it's like pulling a slot machine bar. It's like, hey, did I win? Did I win? Oh, nothing interesting. How about now? Oh, it's so cool. And then you get sucked into this slot machine game. I had a friend who had this very weird experience where he was on, he was just using Facebook. He was just clicking around, browsing. And then suddenly his brain felt bored. So he instinctually opened a tab and typed in Facebook.com. When he landed on Facebook's, his homepage, right, his front feed. And then he was shocked. He was like, whoa, what am I doing? I was already on Facebook, right? This is called the trigger design. which is when you feel bored, that's a trigger to go to Facebook.com. It doesn't even matter if you're already on Facebook or not. So it's like when you're bored, when you're in line, you just go to Facebook and then it sucks away your time. So we spend a tremendous amount of our time, especially in the digital world, doing the black hat stuff, right? And we don't get to the white hat things, the, you know, doing things that are actually impactful and meaningful and pursuing your hobby and relationships. But we're just not happy, right? So to combat that, there's two ways to do it. It's all systematic based on the framework. Number one is, as BJ Fogg, this is a Stanford professor of behavior. He says, you need to change your environment, right? And so, which means you literally need to remove the black hat from your life. That's why some people go to a retreat, they go in the mountains, they go to a dojo. And once all of these black hat triggers are gone, no more deadlines, emails shooting at you, you know, exclusive offers, then you're like, all right, what do I actually want to do? I want to focus on things I care about, right? So that's one thing. The second way is to add black hat to the meaningful things you actually want to do. So you're stealing away attention from the black hat towards negative behavior. So for instance, and this is why, for instance, people pay their gym trainers to call them a loser, right? And it's like, it doesn't feel good when they're yelling at you, they're calling you scum of the earth, you're trying to do push-ups and you're sweating. But then it later led you to Core Drive 2, development accomplishment, right? It's like, thank you for pushing me so hard that I could never do myself. And some people just never go to the gym, right? But if they have an appointment with this gym trainer that they paid for, then they should show up. So they're literally adding more black hat into their lives, but the black hat is pointed in a direction that they want. So those are the two main strategies. Of course, the third way is just add a lot of discipline don't look at the black hat and just do the things you actually want to do. It requires discipline or wisdom. But the thing is, for our work, we don't depend on people having discipline. Like I personally, like people think I'm really motivated. I started multiple companies since I was 18. I wrote a book and did all these stuff. I actually don't have a lot of self-control. Like I'm kind of very easily drawn by these core drives, which is why I'm so sensitive about it, and I study it better. But I was lucky because I figured out how to create my environment so it's so engaging, so fun that I don't need self-control to do what most people consider very productive, right? You don't need motivation to play your favorite game. You actually need motivation to stop playing your favorite game. Or you don't need discipline. You need discipline to stop playing your favorite game. And once something becomes a habit, then you don't need motivation to do it, right? You don't need motivation to stop doing your habit. You need motivation to actually stop doing a habit. So those are a few examples. So how do you add, for instance, unpredictable curiosity to your day? Let's say you want to do some things, right? Now, some people, let's say they're doing their to-do list and they're just always trying to get to it. They're like, oh, I'm going to do gamification. They do what we call a fixed action reward at earn lunch. Say, hey, if I do this, I'll treat myself something. This to the brain is not as interesting because it's an extrinsic motivation. It's do X, get Y. And what makes it a little bit interesting is adding some unpredictability and curiosity. So let's say, hey, if I finish the task, I'm gonna roll a dice, right? Sometimes it's more fun. Sometimes it's more fun when you roll two dice, because then you have, you know, the 2, 3, 4s that and 10, 11, 12s that have low probability, and 4, 5, 6 that have high probability. So you could decide what you're going to reward yourself with at the end of it, because we're more driven by that unpredictability. One example I love to share about how we're drawn to unpredictability is if you sit there and you press a button for 4 hours straight and you're guaranteed a paycheck, that's kind of boring, right? That's like a job at a factory. Most people don't like it. But if you sit there and you press a button for 4 hours straight, and maybe you'll get a paycheck, maybe you won't, maybe you'll even lose money, suddenly that's casino gambling. And a lot of people like that. It makes no sense, right? Same behavior. One, you're guaranteed a payout. The other, you're most likely going to lose money. That's how the casino makes so much money. But our brains prefer the latter because we are literally paying for that intrinsic mode feeling of maybe I'll win, that unpredictability. And people come out of the casino saying, hey, I lost $300, but you know, that was so much fun. Let's go back next week. So adding a bit of unpredictability, adding more social influence relatedness, that's Core Drive 5. So things like competition, collaboration. Now, collaboration is white hat, makes people feel good and happy, but oftentimes there's no urgency, right? Everyone's just like nice and cuddly and it's like, hey, but no one's like very driven to do it now. Competition is more black hat, which means it drives short-term a lot of urge, like, hey, I'm going to beat him, I don't want to lose. But if it's over the long term, like over a year of competing with each other, most people get burnt out because it's black hat. So that's why a lot of these wearables fail, because it's all about competition. People are competitive for the first 2 to 4 months and they burn out. So it's also about balancing the collaboration with competition. A lot of times team competition is the best balance because it has the collaboration side and also has the competitive side. So, you know, just adding a lot of these core drives into our daily habits and daily activities, very useful. I can later share with more time, I can later share how I use some of these principles to finish my book also. But of course, there's a lot of other examples in fitness and education, whatnot.
Yuka, I'm incredibly interested in this, and particularly as you mentioned before, the fact that you don't necessarily have an iron will and you have actually constructed your day-to-day environment in such a way that it kind of motivates you and gets you towards completing these core tasks that are going to push you on spiritually, professionally, etc. And I'm just wondering if you can just give some concrete examples of how you actually do this, something that the audience can really take away with them.
The motivation for me to start my book was, again, I was just blogging, and I've had, you know, probably 500,000 people who read my blog a year. And so they kept saying, hey, Yuka, when is your book coming out? When is your book coming out? And after 2 years of that, I thought, maybe I should start writing a book, right? So I wasn't like super driven and motivated, like, oh, this is my plan. I'm going to write a book and build my brand through a book and become an author. It was really, people just kept nudging me. And this is literally what we call CoDrive 5, social influence and relatedness. People kept asking for it. So I started, right? But I wasn't necessarily driven towards it internally. It was more like, hey, let me just do it because everyone asked for it. So, and then writing was kind of interesting, but obviously I wasn't a full-time author writer. I was doing a lot of consulting with companies, with doing design projects that, you know, are over, like each are over $100,000. And at any given moment, there's clients saying, hey, when are you going to get this done? There are new clients that want to show up. I had new people to train. So I had to, it's very hard to carve out time to write a book. And so at the beginning, I resorted to a black hat strategy because I needed urgency, right? So what I did was I had a full day workshop about maybe 7 months after that point. So in the marketing, I put, hey, if you pay for this workshop, it's $1,000 per person. But if you pay for this workshop, you will get a signed copy of my first book that's going to come out, right? And so that's black hat's loss and avoidance, because I literally said, oh, wow, I already promised people that I'll give them a book, so I better start writing. And so that put a lot of pressure, right? I didn't need a lot of self-control. That just the fact that I'm going to be in a workshop full of people who paid a decent amount of money expecting the book and I don't have it, it's really embarrassing, right? And it's almost beyond embarrassing. And so that drove me to write like crazy. So again, this is black hat, and later on we're going to talk about how it transitions to white hat. But it's a black hat. I wrote like crazy. Every day I spent, you know, 3 to 6 hours just writing. And it has the same consequence of black hat, which means, number one, sometimes I did fall behind on client work, because you could say that the deadline, the negative consequence of that was worse than the client stuff. So I fell a little behind. But then at one point, okay, about 2-3 months away from the workshop, I conclude that, wait, there is no possible way I could finish my book by the time the workshop hits, right? And so because it's like a 500-page book and has a lot of scientific research and studies in it. And at that point, you know, black hat predicts my behavior, which is I totally got burned out. I didn't want to touch the book at all for like quite a while. And so black hat is useful for short bursts of activity. If you can use the black hat and push yourself through to the finish line, that's amazing, right? A two-week competition or having loss of wonder, scarcity, unpredictability. If it pushes you through, that's great. But if it doesn't push you through, black hat is terrible for long-term engagement motivation. So people burn out. So later afterwards, I transitioned. Oh, by the way, then I decided that I had to tell the email the attendees, hey, the book isn't finished, but you know, if you give me your address, I'll mail it to you afterwards, right? So it's not the full embarrassment, but it of course wasn't that nice. So then I transitioned to the white hat strategy. So what happened? The reason why it's also so difficult to write the book is because during the day I would do a lot of the client stuff, answer a lot of emails, and then once I get to a milestone, you know, that's when I should be writing my book, right? But I feel pretty tired. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go take a break first, you know, either take a walk or talk to some people or play a little game. And then after that, maybe I'll just play a game, right? And then after that, that's when I'm supposed to write my book. But then I suddenly have all these other triggers again. The emails are coming in, more projects, and I do that. And then I go back to taking a break, and then I go back through. So I never get to my book. So what I realized is I could add a few components. First of all, I needed to make myself curious, unpredictable in curiosity, right? So, and also empowerment of creative feedback. So what I realized is when I actually touch my book, I actually really enjoy writing. It's a very creative process. And so I end up writing more. The problem is that I don't want to touch it because it feels like a daunting task. It feels like quote unquote work, and I don't want to get there. So what I did is I made a rule where every time I finish my client projects to your milestone and I want to take a break, before I play a game, I'm just going to read the last paragraph I wrote. Now, I'm not going to read the last chapter. I'm not going to write a new paragraph. I'm just going to read the last paragraph. And I'm curious, right? Usually when you write, you actually don't remember what was the last stuff you write. Maybe you wrote, maybe it's crap. So I was just curious, like, hey, yeah, let me check. So before I go play a game, I'm going to read this paragraph. But the moment I read that paragraph, I just automatically start writing because, again, it's a creative process and I intrinsically enjoy it. So I start writing. And then afterwards, I write for 1 or 2 hours and I'm like, oh, client stuff happens again. I have to deal with it. And oh, I'm really tired now. I'm going to go play a game. Oh, wait, before I play a game, I have to read the last paragraph. And I start writing for another 1 or 2 hours. And I remember there was a very funny moment. At the time, I was complaining to my mother-in-law who was living with us. And I said, oh, I'm so angry. I want to play a game, but I never get to playing the game because I keep writing my book, you know, and that's very successful, right? It's like, I'm angry because I don't do the things that are wasting my time. I'm doing the things that are actually the things that I want to do. And I can't even control myself. I have to do the things I'm supposed to do. So that strategy eventually led me to finish the book and feel really good about it throughout the experience.
I think that story is great, and that's certainly something that people can take away with them. But have you got any examples, again, of the way that the same framework has been used in the workplace?
Yeah, so we work with a lot of different projects. So we work with the largest steel factory in the world to motivate people to have safer behavior, reduce injuries. And it's about how to create exciting epic journey to report and remove hazards in the factory, and it's through, you know, unlockables. When you do these desired behavior, you have unlockables, collection sets. We work with some big car companies on loyalty programs in terms of, hey, if when you drive with these cars and you drive in with good, safe, and environmental friendly behavior, you actually could accumulate credit to upgrade to their premium brands, right? So let's say we don't work with this particular company, but let's a random example is, hey, if you drive a Toyota a lot in the right way, then you can upgrade to a Lexus more easily, kind of like that. And there's some projects are for eBay, for instance. The goal was to motivate their small C2C sellers to become professional sellers. So this I can share a bit more examples in slightly more detail. So of course, their goal was to reduce BBEs, bad buying experiences, because sometimes the small C2C sellers, they have really niche interesting products, but they're not really good at providing good customer service or describing the product really well. So the few angles we looked at was, well, first of all, can we add epic meaning and calling to this experience? You know, in a game, it's often about saving the world, doing something big and grand. In reality, people feel like what they're doing is mundane, right? So the reason why these small sellers are worse sellers is not because they're dumber, it's because they don't care, right? They just think they're getting rid of stuff from their garage. So if there's a way to inspire them, make them believe that, hey, look, I'm selling stuff on eBay, which means I'm running my own business, I'm an entrepreneur, right? If I'm running my own business, of course I should provide better service and describe things better and ship faster. So it's to motivate them into like more of a gameful mentality. That's step one. Step two is to have a journey of improvement. I mean, eBay already has that gamified journey about going from a yellow star seller to a power rated seller, you know, things like that. But we have a more of a standards place where it says, hey, you're here, but as you keep doing the right desired behavior, uploading for photos, allow print shipping label, you get to level up and you get a lot of benefits. And a lot of times we don't, when we think about rewards, we don't think about just giving out discounts or cash. In gamification, we talk about staff, status, access, power, stuff, which I won't go into too much detail. Basically we give them power ups. So we say, hey, if you're constantly taking a lot of photos and allowing print shipping label, we'll give you a seller's kit, which is like a portable backdrop. So you can take even better photos. You can play the game even better, right? It's like a more powerful sword, or a portable way, which you can, you know, enter the weight of a product more easily and do print shipping labels more easily. So we give them boosters in the engagement. So now the user has a journey to level up, they get boosters and power-ups, and there's a higher sense of purpose and meaning. So that's, I guess, one of a slightly more detailed example of how we use some of these gamification principles to engage desired behavior.
I think that's absolutely fascinating, and it's also a really good spot to stop now. Where can people find out more about you and your work and connect with you?
Okay, so the easiest way to learn about the Octalis framework is if you go on YouTube. I have a TEDx talk that's 17 minutes. If you just search gamification on YouTube, it should be the first result. So that's the easy, quick way to get there. If you go to my blog, yukaichao.com, I have a lot more content and information. If you find that interesting, you want to go deeper, my book, Actionable Gamification, Beyond Points, Badges, and Leaderboards is on amazon.com, so you can buy that. And the so far the deepest part of this journey, if you want to really learn all this stuff, I have a gamified education platform called Octalis Prime. It is a monthly subscription, so it's not free, but it's much cheaper than university program, let's say. But it already has 300 plus videos I've made on how to utilize these 8 core drives to make our lives better, to be happier, to find purpose, to be more productive, or to motivate your customers or employees, etc. So it's something that I've been very passionate about. So those are various ways, and like a lot of it's free. So check out the free stuff, and if you want more, then there's like the book and whatnot that costs some amount, but none of it is like you don't have to go through the $1,000 workshop or anything else if you just want to apply this to your own life.
Well, Yukai, thanks so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate you sharing your insights and wisdom with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for running this show.